This week, we discuss rights. Right?
Right. Right.
Plus a whole lot more on the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you.
The Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
To remind
Process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome to episode 12. We are going to be discussing rights and where do they come from, what are they, who defines them. This is potentially a pretty big topic, but we're going to try and do it justice. I'm Jerry.
I'm Ken.
And I'm Rob.
And I'm back.
Ken is back. Welcome
back. You are
back.
So back.
With a vengeance.
How was vacation?
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Cheater. I'm probably going to leave again. Maybe in the middle of this episode. I haven't decided yet. So if I cut out, that might be why.
All right. Well, we'll try not to stress you out too bad. Well, we will go into some listener feedback here to start things off this time before we get to our main event. Our listener, Eric, has this to say about our discussion last time regarding militias. You should watch the Penn and Teller bullshit episode about gun control. They basically say that the founding fathers put provisions in place to overthrow government, too. Jerry would probably like that episode. Similarly, was it legal or right for the southern states to secede, and was the North out of line to start the Civil War?
There's an episode there.
You think that's a whole episode to itself?
Well, you know the phrase in the South for the, they don't call it the Civil War, it's the right. War of Northern Aggression.
Right, right.
Yes, they're still hung up on that a little bit. They didn't like the little touchdown dance that happened in Savannah. Didn't really need to spike it right there in the ocean,
true.
Did you?
Hey. There was no 15-yard penalties for excessive celebration back then, so.
Sherman spared Savannah, though, because it was such a beautiful city, and it still is to this day.
Should have torched it.
Apologies to all of our
right,
Savannah
with apologies
listeners.
To all our Georgia listeners.
Sorry about that. That's Rob, by the way.
Oh, I've never been there. I'm sure it's
I'll post his
grand.
Address later.
So I think that's a fair question that Eric asks is, was it legal or right for the southern states to secede? And my answer would be yes, most definitely. I think, you know, membership in the Union was voluntary to begin with. And I think, you know, if you choose to join the Union, you should be able to choose to leave it.
Is there anything in the Constitution about the leaving part?
Nope.
Just maybe you can do it.
Yeah, well, apparently you can't, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the precedent that was set here. Is that?
Oh, you try, can. You're just
you try to leave. We're gonna, you know, destroy your state.
Yeah,
I did always.
Don't
think
you
it
think
was
that's odd. Legal though as well?
What
is what the North did illegal? I mean, it might be ill-advised, but they, I don't know.
I think we lost sense of legal at some point, didn't we? No habeas corpus.
Yeah, I
sure.
That's the only writ I know.
I don't.
Very good.
It's one of my favorite writs.
It is your only favorite writ, right? I don't believe that Lincoln's response was legitimate.
Legitimate in what sense?
I don't believe he had the authority to prevent states seceding. So I think he overstepped his bounds and, you know.
I'm going to show my ignorance here, but I am assuming So when the South seceded, certain states of the South seceded and formed the Confederate States of America,
right.
I am assuming that as opposed to the remaining United States of America via Congress and the President declaring war on the Confederate States of America, they did not recognize the Confederate States of America and went to war with them to prevent them from leaving. Is that a fair assessment? Was there any legal declaration of war on the Confederate States of America?
That I don't know.
I would assume there wasn't because they probably didn't recognize it, but I don't know that. So,
yeah. What was the legal claim that it was like taken over by rogue state governments that needed to get the smackdown? Was that
brought back in line?
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah,
I don't know these details. Good job, education.
Yeah, we're.
Public school at its finest.
Well, we do know that the entire Civil War was fought only over the issue of slavery, right? We were all taught that. So,
right.
Another failure of our education system.
I did, even as a kid, I always thought it was odd. Just felt strange that the Civil War is like, so you got these people wanting to leave. So you go and you kind of whoop them up a little bit, and that'll teach you to stay. You know, I didn't really get that. Always seemed odd.
Well, it worked, didn't it?
It worked, but it was like...
It is an odd response. We're going to go kill a bunch of you and make you stay.
Right, because we love you so much.
That'll learn you.
Right.
You come back or there's going to be some more killing.
Yes, the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Should Lincoln's response have been, oh, well, they seceded. See you later. Welcome to the Confederate States of America.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, membership was voluntary.
Yeah.
You join a club, you don't expect them to come after you and beat the crap out of you if you decide not to.
The first rule of the United States of America is you don't ask about the United States of America.
That's right.
I don't know. It's hardly unique in the history of man to respond in such a way. I don't know. I don't know.
And what if you're the Bloods and the Crips? You got to get beat out of that gang.
Right. There you go. Yeah, you don't just leave. I mean, I think preserving the Union was a noble goal. You could argue the merits of the way it was gone about, but I don't know.
Well, I'm not sure how noble it really was.
What do you think the motive was?
Oh, I'm not saying
you're saying an ulterior motive. You're just saying that.
Yeah, I'm just saying that's not enough of a justification for the response that, you know, was given.
Well, who fired the first shots of the Civil War?
Well, that was Fort Sumter, right? Mm-hmm. So it was South Carolina. Firing on, I guess it was northern ships.
In response to what? I mean, I assume they seceded, you know, said, hey, we are issuing our intent to secede from the Union.
Yeah.
So why did they fire the first shots? Was it due to a blockade? Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
They were the North were sneering at them menacingly. I mean, I don't know what. Yes. I'm just wondering why the South fired the first shots. Given, I would think that the opposite would have happened, that the North would have come in and said, "Hey, you can't do that. We're going to shoot at you first." But that's not what happened. So, but if the North was blockading or was in some way impeding the South's secession, then you know. I guess I don't. I don't know all the pertinent details of the start of it. I know just enough of it, you know, to get to the part where the important part where Lincoln freed the slaves, because that's what the Civil War is all about. So,
geez, so on that.
I am on that. It's annoying because that's not what the Civil War was about. But that's what we've turned it into, and I think that's obnoxious. But I believe that the South had the right to secede. I think if Texas wanted to secede, they should be able to secede. It'd be very interesting to see what the response would be now.
Yeah,
and I don't know how secession happens. If there's no provision for it in the Constitution, if a state just comes and says, I'm out, what happens from a legal sense?
I mean, I think we've seen what happened in the past. I don't know.
Yeah, the only precedent is not very promising. So,
But, you know, my response would be nothing happens. They just leave, you know, and the rest of us say, bye-bye, so long. Yeah.
Can we get certain states to secede? Like, can we vote and make them secede?
I don't think so.
No, that's too bad.
Like Survivor, okay. You just vote them off the island?
Yeah, because I can think of a handful that could go away right now. And
hey, I wonder which ones we would pick. I bet we'd pick different ones. I think we'd
pick different ones. I suspect. Yeah, I don't know. It'd be interesting to read a little more legalistic, I guess, analysis of how all that went down. I mean, there's provisions for getting admitted to the union, is there not?
Yes.
But nothing for leaving. It's interesting. No.
Perhaps that was an oversight on the
maybe
the framers' part.
Which is surprising, I guess, because I would think that given, you know, the question that Eric asked about the militias, and I know the amendment of right to bear arms is hotly debated, you know, because the language is written in X time ago, and people say, well, obviously it means this, and obviously it means that, blah, blah, blah. That's a whole nother discussion. But I believe if you read outside of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers' intent, that is why that is there, is to kind of have that specter of, you know, accountability there for the people that are governed to be able to not to allow them to overthrow the government anytime they feel like it, but to have that there as sort of the ultimate check and balance.
Yeah.
And I'm way okay with that. I think that's fine. I don't think that's something you do lightly. You don't say, well, I think, you know, I don't like this, so I'm just going to go ahead and, well, let's revolt. That's not a valid response. I think it's got to be a pretty extreme situation. But
It's
happened once in our history. That's how we got here.
Read the Declaration of Independence. You can see the long list of injuries and usurpations that are itemized in there that mm-hmm. King George had committed against the colonists.
Right.
In my eyes, the list today is much longer than the list back then. So.
But we have a lot cooler stuff, too, so.
Yeah, you know, right.
The list of positives is good as well.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know if, in the grand scheme, if the offenses of today are better or worse. I don't know.
I do think some of these states that think they're all super independent aren't as independent as they think they are.
I think that's probably true.
Sounds nice.
And some are better set up to be independent than others, right? I mean, but I agree with you. I don't think they're as independent as they think. And
Hawaii.
The Republic of Texas would struggle despite their blustering, you know. Yeah, I don't see that going as well quite as they think it would. But you know what? It would be whatever. So I say give it a shot. Let's do we're going to do this ship off the coast and live in international waters. Let's let a state secede and see what happens. We've got all these experiments we need to do. We need to start picking states and making it happen. So
yeah,
I'm all on board. Interestingly enough, I guess, well I'm going to sidetrack here a little bit because there's some stuff from my vacation that I do want to share for those of our listeners who are not, you know, dear friends of mine and didn't keep up, but I went to the state, I'll use that in protest to Jerry, of the state of Hawaii, and it was a very interesting trip. So a very interesting place, a lot of unique people there with interesting opinions about the government that we have and they have.
And stop weaseling around.
History of Hawaii. So I'm not weaseling, it's called build up. Come on.
Oh, are you getting there?
No, I'm not going to tell you now. So just there's a couple stories just about how they became a territory. And, you know, I think, Jerry, you may have even talked about that on previous episodes. I don't remember. But, I mean, the overthrow of the King of Hawaii happened in the late 1800s.
Right.
And, you know, it was all business related. It was not sanctioned by anyone. But there was kind of tacit approval because the government of the United States didn't really do anything about it. They just kind of turned a blind eye.
Right.
Because there's cash involved. So for the next 57 years or whatever, it was in that state, and then became a territory in 1950 and a state in 1959. But a couple interesting stories. I about. One is kind of a free markety type story that Rob will enjoy, because this is one of his things that he likes, is to find places where the free market fails. But Hawaii like had a dairy industry. You know, Hawaii did not have, because of its remote location, a lot of native flora and fauna and animal life. Not a lot of different species. So when Europeans and Americans came, you know, they brought a lot of horses, cows, plants, you know, all that kind of stuff. Cats, dogs, all that. So cows ended up there. They have a dairy industry, but, you know, land's at a premium there, and they have to pay a little bit more for their milk, you know. So the California dairy industry trucks on in and says, oh, you don't need to pay, you know, $2 a gallon for milk. You should pay $1.50. So California is selling milk for $1.50, and Hawaii dairy industry says, hey, don't buy into this. You know, they're just trying to ace us out. You know, buy local, buy American, right? The same kind of motto you hear now.
Yeah.
So, of course, the Hawaiians, like all other people, bought what was cheapest, and eventually the Hawaii dairy industry went under, and immediately the California dairy industry quadrupled their prices. So milk is $8 a gallon in Hawaii.
Free market.
Yeah, and there it is, right? I mean, that's the free market. So now it's $8 a gallon. Now, I guess the counter argument to that is somebody could come along and start a dairy farm in Hawaii and sell $5 a gallon milk, and it would be cheaper, and then you'd have a price war. But that hasn't happened for whatever reason. But something that I was told as well that I haven't been able to verify, so I don't know if I was sold a bill of goods. So if any listener can find anything on this, but we were told by one member of our tour group, the leader of one of our tour groups, that the Kingdom of Hawaii is still in existence, has been recognized by the United Nations, and there's 50,000 people that are members of the Kingdom of Hawaii that do not pay income tax. And we did drive by the palace. That's the only operational palace in the United States. That I could find was a true statement. But the legal status of the Kingdom of Hawaii is in question, I guess. But I haven't looked into it a lot. But there was a lot of signs places where they were kind of protesting, I guess, their, you know, inclusion in the union. It was interesting. So, and it wasn't really, I don't want to say it was violent. It's not the same. Like here, when people take up a cause, they get real militants, maybe not the right word, but they're much more emphatic about it. There, they're super friendly. They're super nice. And they're very appreciative that we come and spend our money there, because tourism is obviously their number one business.
Sure.
So they love our money. But they also don't like, you know, some of the shenanigans that go on. And anything here that we kind of think ill of, you know, such as the government corruption and backdoor deals and eminent domain and using all these tools of government to kind of manipulate the community to make money, they happen there in spades. I mean, there's signs up all over the place protesting eminent domain and just countless story after story of people getting kicked out of lifelong homes, you know, so they can build high rises and vacation resorts. And, you know, here it's for malls and businesses and such, but there it's, you know, there's a lot more money involved. And any corruption that we experience here, from the stories I heard just the brief time I was there, just pale in comparison to what they go through there. So it was kind of like a microcosm of all the problems we have in one little area.
You know, yeah.
A very desirable area. The whole thing is an island. The majority of it is coastline. It's beautiful. It's, you know, people are willing to spend big dollars. And that leads to a lot of bad behavior on the part of people who are in power.
I think I mentioned in a previous episode that Hawaii was illegally annexed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was when we were talking about Obama and whether or not he had been born there.
Right.
And, you know.
You said it doesn't matter because
Hawaii. Yeah, because Hawaii's not a state, so it really doesn't matter where he was born.
They're very proud of their Obama, though.
Yeah, I know. They called him the Hawaii's third senator when he made it to the Senate.
Ah, okay.
Right.
But I did drive by the place where he went to grade school and hospital where he was born and
supposedly
an apartment he lived in, and you know, it was great.
Allegedly,
right. Yes.
In 1993, Bill Clinton issued a formal apology to the state of Hawaii for illegally annexing their their country.
Sorry about that.
Well, we're not giving it back.
That was the 100th anniversary of that event.
1893. Yes.
Typical Democrat, always apologizing.
Yeah, they do like to do that. He also apologized for dropping the bomb, did he not?
He might have.
I think he did.
He apologized 95. A lot.
He did. A lot to Hillary as well for later transgressions.
Yeah, what you got me on the milk thing, your dairy anecdote.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great story though, because
it's a great story.
Totally free market in action, and there's really not a whole lot you can say about that. But yet you can't look at that and claim that good came out of that.
Right.
It just is. So you can debate the merits of it ad nauseum, but I think it's a great story.
It's perfect because someone I discuss things with says, well, free market doesn't mean that there's not winners and losers. Like, you're going to have your winners and your losers. But that's predicated on some kind of fair fight or fair competition or driven by consumer desires. And, you know, I guess it was driven by consumers because they all took the cheap milk. But it's that short-term kind of game that gets played that doesn't
unintended
end up
– consequences.
Right. But it's actually it depends on what your consequences you focus on. If you're focusing on a for-profit motive, those consequences are exactly what was intended. It worked out exactly as planned. But that doesn't make things good.
But I don't think the California dairy industry had an obligation to come in and say, look, guys, here's the deal. We're going to undercut their price, and when you put them under, we are going to bend you over and screw you hard. All right, break. You know, I don't think they have to say that. So I don't think it has to be fair. So I don't think free market means fair. It just means it's free. And people made a choice, and they didn't think about it, and they got what they deserved. Bummer.
Well, and I would disagree with your statement earlier when you said no good came out of that. That's from the perspective of the Hawaiians, but obviously the people who work in the California dairy industry, a lot of good came out of that.
Sure.
They opened up a whole new market.
Right. Yep.
So, you know, assigning good and bad values to something like that is a pretty subjective thing.
Sure. Yeah, it's perspective. And how do you prevent that? I mean, you say that's the free market in action. What would you do to prevent that?
Would you
pass a law that says you have to sell milk for at least this price? Because
it's not a free market.
Exactly. But isn't that what we do with gasoline and
countless
other things? So, I mean, you know, when we rail on the free market, you know, I think a lot of times we're not really railing on a free market. We're railing on our version of the free market.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so let me move on to Eric's other comment. He says, 1/3 of people want to overthrow the government. That would be an interesting poll to conduct. I firmly believe a large percentage of people are dissatisfied with the current government, but I'd be willing to bet the solutions are all over the place, as would be the description of what the problems actually are. I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, that's actually a good – I mean, that's more well said than I tried to say it, is that yeah, you do have a lot of people who are dissatisfied, but out of that 1/3, I mean, how many of those are radical leftists mad that Obama's not lefty enough? Or Occupy Wall Street. I mean, those Occupy Wall Street people are pretty ticked at the government too, just like the Tea Party folks that want to water the tree of liberty.
Well, according to some, like my father, for instance, all of the Occupy Wall Street protesters are being paid by George Soros to be there.
I got to get in on that. What's he paying?
I don't know, but it must be good.
Well, you got to ask me. I'm the one that has the in. You think you guys got connections?
I might have connections. I'll whore myself out for a little scratch. I'm in.
You'd have to I'll go sleep in a tent and not shave for a month to get paid.
Not too bad.
Depends what they're paying. Yeah, I think one would not have to look far to figure out that despite the fact that a lot of those groups, and I'll include the Tea Party in this despite Rob's snarky comment, that I think a lot of them aren't in this for the same thing.
Oh, most
you know,
definitely.
There's you can.
They are not a monolithic organization by any.
Despite the portrayal that they are, you know, just a bunch of, you know, whatever characteristic you want to assign to them that's uncomplimentary, I think those people are all over the map, just like OWS is.
Yeah.
Then God love them. Go get them. I mean, that's great. I think they yeah. – I find it funny. You know, again, we've talked about this, how depending which side of the spectrum you're on, one of these movements is legitimate and the other one is just a travesty when, in fact, they're not that much different.
Well, yeah, they're probably both equally legitimate and travesty-like.
Yeah, right, because there's a mix of all kinds of people in there. And if you want it to be a travesty, you'll find the person and go, oh, that's what this is all about.
One thing
if you want
different.
It to be legitimate, you'll find people right. that are legitimate. So.
Sure. I mean, one thing that's different, that's fun to think about, is the use of patriotism and love for country that gets bandied about. You know, would you say the Occupy Wall Street people are patriotic, or that they care about the country?
Yes.
I think they would say they do.
Right, right.
And I think people that have a more opinion in line with theirs would say they're the ones that are being patriotic and aren't misusing the patriotism thing.
Right.
But there's a lot of the right that would look at ODOs and say that is anti-American, right? Because that's the shtick right now for the right. Everything's
right.
about patriotism.
Yeah, I don't even know how you define that, to be perfectly honest. You know, what is a patriot now?
I would argue anybody that wants to go out and have a legal protest, isn't that? I mean, what more patriotic thing can you do than that? Right?
Yeah, right.
That's
exercising your First Amendment rights.
It's in the Constitution that you can go do that. I mean, if you're not being violent and you're not disrupting something and you're having a peaceful protest, I don't care if you're protesting against the designated hitter. Go get them. Knock yourselves out. That's great. Good for them.
But our protests have drum circles. Like, until I see a Tea Party drum circle, I'm going to stick with my side.
Hmm.
Okay. Tea Party drum circle would just be like a marching band drum line.
Right.
That adds legitimacy to the movement.
That's right.
I see.
They would all be armed, though.
Right.
Instead of handbells, it would just be guys with handguns going off to make a tune. I'd watch that. That'd be kind of cool.
That'd be good.
I don't know. Like, what does the left say about the Tea Party? What's the knock on the Tea Party?
They're
racist, right? Just a bunch of white guys. They're all angry racists.
It's not a very racially diverse group, but I don't think that makes them racist, as we've discussed.
No.
I think one thing that comes out is if you want to talk about the kind of the race thing, what comes out is all the smacking of like these that the government's taken over by non-Americans, that these aren't real Americans. We have these usurpers who have come in that aren't our people and they're taking over our thing, you know, that kind of idea.
Is that a pervading theme, or is that a pervading perception of the theme? I don't know. I mean, I honestly
it could be a perception. I don't know.
No, I think it's the theme. I think,
you think so.
Nine out of 10 people that show up at a Tea Party rally are there to take their country back. You know,
right?
To be the rally cry.
And I think that's the same rally cry in whatever election we just had, 2008. I'm not good with numbers, because they were taking their country back from the George W. Bushes and that kind
right.
of thing. But that's like a quaint kind of take my country back. I get a sketchier feeling about this take our country back, that it's been taken over by un-American usurpers whose primary goal is to destroy the country, and now they're in, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, Jerry, do you not agree with the take our country back?
Take it back from whom?
Right.
Who's in power? I mean,
Okay, but then so what? We're all riding this seesaw, and we're gonna, you know.
Oh, right. Okay, I. It depends if you interpret that statement to mean. I'll take it two ways. If you take that statement to mean, man, things sure were good when W was in charge. We got to get that Obama guy out of there. Or is it like all these guys are a bunch of posers? We need to take our country back and put it in control of people that follow the law and.
Well, I think there's a significant number in the Tea Party that are of that persuasion, that, you know, they feel like, even though most of them identify with the Republican Party, you know, there's a significant number of them that have been disenfranchised from the Republican platform, you know, so okay. they elected all these guys. Now there's a Tea Party caucus in Congress, and I don't know how many how many people that is total. It's not a large number, but you know, they're like beholden now to the Tea Party on any of the votes that they make, any of the decisions that they make in Congress. So I think there is a perception that, you know, they've got a foothold now. They've got a certain number of their Tea Party candidates that have been elected, and now they're going to go in there and, you know, whip up on all the business as usual inside the Beltway guys and change things for the better.
Is that all bad? That doesn't sound all bad to me. I guess it depends on what they're doing. So,
no, I don't think that's bad. I don't think it in reality is what they believe it is.
Oh, I agree with that. Right. I mean, once you get big enough, like you said, that you have a caucus and you have a party that you're beholden to, and you're getting strong-armed and pressured, and you have a platform instead of just saying, I'm going to do what I think is right, because that's why I'm here, is to not do the status quo. Once you have your own status quo, you haven't really changed anything.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the Tea Party is there yet. I mean, they still don't have like a national infrastructure. There's no, you know, there's no party chairman. There's it's still, for the most part, a grassroots movement. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's headed in that direction, it seems.
But that's the danger of any third party thing, right? Is you start by kind of being a spoiler,
right?
And then to get legitimacy, you've got to get.
You have to become the thing you hate.
Exactly. You got to get some critical mass that you've got a foothold, and then what are you? I mean,
right.
You're part of the evil empire now, and you're making scratch, and you're selling books, and you're getting embroiled in controversies, and you're trying to get reelected, and you're trying to get, you know, money through fundraisers, and you've got lobbyists, and okay, what just happened?
Right.
You know, now somebody else is going to pop up and be the spoiler. So,
but I think if to get legitimate, if you really wanted to be a legitimate organization, I think you need that platform, and that step hasn't happened either. I think it's more of an expression of anger, just like the Wall Street thing is.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like you can go look at a cogent, nice list of Occupy Wall Street platform points. You know,
I thought they issued a press release or something. Somebody did. I don't know. Somebody did, right.
It was kind of crazy.
Gave
it was
the like, points. And they were rather silly, as I remember.
Right. It's like free college for everyone.
Yeah.
Like,
you know, come on. Exactly. Right. I read some of those. I thought, boy, talk about, you know.
And we want the letter M stricken from the English language.
Right.
Yes. We want a shrubbery. Yeah, I read that and I thought, that's what this boils down to, is we want free college tuition for everybody? Okay.
Right.
Good deal. Go get them, Tiger. Right. I don't know.
Yeah, and the Tea Party thing is just, it's just so mad. I mean, which is fine. I mean, I think
there's a lot of anger.
Pretty angry group right now.
Yep. That's good. Need a little anger.
I wanted to move into the rest of our listener feedback here. Our listener Nathan said, in the conception of the militia by the founders, everyone is a member of the militia under United States law. All males 18 years old and older are members. I'm pretty sure there's also a state law in Missouri that says all 18-year-olds or older males are militia members. So legally, there is no difference between active and passive militias, yet they are treated differently by those in so-called law enforcement. So I, you know, we covered that briefly, and we were kind of talking around what a militia actually is. But by law, any male 18 or older is part of the militia.
Where does it say such a thing?
I'll have a link in the show notes to.
Okay.
But it's volume 10 of the United States Code, section 311. All able-bodied men 17 to 45 are militia members.
Sweet.
Well, that's pretty clear.
I don't know. You got to really get some interpretation to that.
We need some Supreme Court justices.
We do.
For
that. We need a 5-4 decision on this quickly. Well, sweet. I've got like 4 more years to be in the militia. I got to go get me some GATs.
Some GATs.
All right, you're out right now just for saying
that's
that.
That's it. Sorry, you can't be in the militia.
Nathan went on to say, on the usage tax issue / living without getting taxed, Jeremy made the comment that you can barter. However, if you barter with your labor, the IRS claims that what you get in exchange is income and thus taxable. Of course, all work is really just exchanging labor for something else, so it isn't really income. But try telling that to the IRS.
All right, IRS. Let's tell them that.
Well, I think that's an interesting point as well, yeah. That, you know, basically everything you own is something you exchanged your labor for.
True.
So, yeah, I think he's made his point. This comment plus the one from last time when, you know, he said, unless you're planning to live out in the middle of nowhere and grow all your own food, you can't really avoid a usage tax or a consumption tax.
Kingdom of Hawaii.
Yeah.
That's where we're going to do our remote broadcast from.
Sweet.
The palace.
Are you paying?
No, we'll get our sponsors to
okay.
pay.
All right.
You do it right under the there? Statue of King Kamehameha.
Okay.
Oof. Do it. I'll get it set up.
All right. We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to jump into the main event.
Look, I when I was a kid, I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Back, and it is time for the main event.
Let's get ready to ramble!
And we are going to talk about rights. What are they, and where do they come from? So,
oh boy.
Who wants to start?
Go ahead, Rob.
There you go.
I want somebody to say something outrageous so I can get fired up.
Yeah, you just want to rebut.
Well, where do you think rights come from?
Well, I guess what is step one here? We got to classify the types of rights, you know,
well,
like your
no,
human rights and your nationwide rights. And
let's just say, for the sake of argument, we know rights exist. There is a set of rights. Where does that set come from?
I'll say the global set just comes from humankind.
Okay.
Religious and say it's, you know, endowed by the creator to have inalienable rights. I don't want to say that though. But
why not?
It is a good phrase actually. Because I don't want to tie it to government.
Okay.
Tied to government.
It is.
Go ahead. You finish.
But yeah, I just want to say that's a good phrase. I mean, that phrase is in there to push an idea of government, but that phrase works fine on its own.
Well, I disagree that it's tied to government. I mean, that phrase is in the Declaration of Independence. It's one of the self-evident truths.
Right, right.
So the question there is, do we believe that is self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights?
I'll go with that.
I don't believe that's true.
You don't?
No, I think it's a construct. I don't think we are part of – I'll get very simplistic here. We are – are we not part of the – animal kingdom? Would you agree with that? I mean, that's the kingdom we are in, right?
To the extent that we're not plants or fungi.
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't... unless you have an artificial construct in place that defines and enforces those rights, I don't think you have any rights. I think that's a human creation.
Right. They're human rights. They're endowed by the creator.
I won't even go there because I don't think that means anything. So, okay, they're endowed by the creator. So, Like, give me a right that's endowed to you by your creator.
Right to life.
Okay, I kill you. What happens?
My creator comes and stomps you.
That does not happen, at least that I've seen. I haven't seen evidence of that.
Well, I think the question there is, obviously, the victim's dead, so
yep. You know,
it's over for him. But
true.
The question is, how is the perpetrator perceived by those that are still alive and around?
Yeah. Okay.
Would they view that act as being right or wrong?
I would say it probably is wrong, but it depends. If everybody's sure. really scared of that person that just killed that other person, they might view them as not saying anything.
You're right.
They're afraid they'd be next.
There are a lot of mitigating circumstances there.
Sure.
But
I guess my point is I don't think rights are something that's not real, but I think there are something that we create.
Okay, but my
as
point,
people to add structure
my
to
point
something
is,
that would otherwise be chaos.
If I murder you,
mm-hmm.
we don't need a piece of paper somewhere where it says murder is wrong to know that that was wrong, right? The people who witness it know in their heart that, you know, that act was wrong, that it was immoral. It didn't need to be written down on a piece of paper somewhere for them to know that.
Right. I hear what you're saying. You don't need a document in a government to tell you that.
Right.
But that comes from our inherent sense of fairness and whatever you apply that to, right? And I think there's a bar there. I think you can start there because it's an obvious example, but you can go down the number line and get to a point where you might say something is a right and I might say something's not. We get into a gray area very quickly.
Maybe.
I mean, stealing is wrong and killing is wrong, but it's wrong for us because we've evolved to a certain point where we recognize that we have control over those things and don't have to do these base selfish acts in order to survive. We can all survive together and have this system in place, whatever it might be, that recognizes these rights. I just don't think they get enforced in any way unless you have that construct there. What if somebody disagrees and says, I think killing's perfectly fine. If you don't want to get killed, then be stronger. I mean, there's plenty of instances in history that are like that, right? You take what you want.
Yeah, but that's might makes right.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I don't know about you, but I generally consider that to be wrong.
Oh, I agree.
But why is it wrong? Why do you perceive that as wrong? Because you understand that one party is imposing their will on another party
sure.
and violating their rights in the process. You recognize those natural rights that they possess.
Right. It seems wrong from a gut perspective. Like you don't need to look in the back of the index.
Right. I think that our current justice system is predicated on each individual's ability to judge the morality of another person's actions. That's why we have juries who sit down and weigh the facts of a case, and they determine whether or not the defendant's actions were moral. Everyone is capable of doing that. It's a basic human instinct that evolved right alongside our ability to, you know, throw rocks accurately and to avoid falling off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
We got an evolutionary advantage by learning how to do that.
Right.
Because it meant that we could judge the actions of other people and we could tell which people were good people we should hang around and which people weren't.
Right.
And that would, you know, make us live longer generally.
But I don't know that I think in my that those rights are given to us by some other entity other than ourselves.
Well,
I think those rights are there because we recognize I wouldn't want that done to me.
I think so, what Rob said initially is true. I think they derive from just humankind, you know, just our nature as humans. Part of our nature is that we each have individual rights. Now, where did humans come from? Did God create us? Did we evolve? Did both, you know, are both of those statements true? Who cares? It doesn't matter. We're here and we have rights because we claim them.
Yes.
Maybe I'm mixing up the existence of those rights with the enforcement or the protection of those rights. And those are hard things to separate, I would say. But,
yeah. Or, I see what you're saying. You know, possessing a right and being able to exercise it are two different things.
Right.
Right. And I thought you were getting mixed up with us as humans versus just animal beasts out there, you know, when that.
Well, I mean, ultimately, that's what we are. We've just gotten, we've like exactly what Jerry said, we've evolved to a point where we recognize that's not, we don't have to be that way to live. We can,
right.
Makes we can us a, recognize these rights and respect them and live by them and still all prosper.
Right. It makes us human. Like when that fox goes and chows on that chicken, you know, I wouldn't say he's violating the chicken's rights. It just sucks to be a chicken.
It does suck to be the chicken. So you don't think that chicken has any rights?
Chicken does have a right. It has a right to
be chomp a chicken. On some,
to be a chicken and chomp on some grubs in the dirt and be really tasty.
That's tasty.
They are.
But I mean, one could one not make the same argument? And you know, if somebody said, "Look, you know, you've got stuff. I want your stuff. I want to take it." But it's there's societal pressure there that.
It's not just society, it's just humanness.
If you read Thomas Paine's Common Sense, he makes the argument in there that anytime you have a group of people that are living together, that government of some kind will spontaneously form among them. And the reason that is because we are human, we're not perfect creatures. So sooner or later, somebody is going to do something to harm someone else. And, you know, it's that function of resolving disputes that government is supposed to fulfill.
Yeah. And I think it also, you know, that construct adds order and adds some level of fairness. You know, somebody suffers at the expense of somebody else in the name of fairness.
But
and I think it's.
But where I'm going with that is the dispute itself does not arise because government is there.
Right.
The dispute would arise regardless.
Sure.
And that's because one person feels that their rights have been violated. They have been injured in some way by, you know, the other party.
Right.
And that's the source of the dispute. You know, whatever system of government is in place, they step in to resolve the dispute by saying, okay, we're going to, you know, we're going to mediate this. We're going to, you know, investigate, gather the facts, present them in a, you know, to an impartial third party of some kind to make a decision who's right and who's wrong.
And then take a bribe and pick the one who pays the most money.
And then pass a law to make the thing that is immoral legal.
Legal. Ah, sarcasm. Like a warm, comfy sweater. But yeah, I mean, but I guess going back to my Animal Kingdom analogy, like even if you look at just society as a whole, and look forget society, look at people. There are alpha people, just like there are alpha animals. Are there not? I mean, are there people that are not of a certain ilk? There's a hierarchy, even without a medieval structure to our society that there's the haves and there's the have-nots and there's people that are in power. And I think those things ebb and flow irrespective of what rights you think people have, doesn't it?
I think society creates those classes.
Well, I would agree with some of them, but I think throwing that out, I think that personality trait exists in some and doesn't exist in others. Of that is maybe exacerbated by society or enabled by society because of money and jobs and influence and various things like that. But
are you saying
that inherent human nature is animalistic?
I think you're right. There are, you know, more aggressive or more assertive personalities that, you know, would tend to gravitate to certain functions within a society.
But I think we recognize and where we separate ourselves from the animal kingdom is we recognize, hey, just being the most aggressive or the strongest or the biggest or the most violent or the most willing to impose your will upon other people does not make you right. Therefore, we are going to respect what we believe are these rights that are independent of your physical characteristics or your mental abilities or whatever, and we're going to adopt rules that protect those rights because we believe they're there.
Yay, government.
Yeah,
but in order to submit or in order to allow the enforcement of those, you have to submit to that authority that says, not only do I recognize these rights, I'm going to protect them.
Right.
And that's, you know, I think what most of us do is say, okay, I recognize this authority that says, you know, this is wrong and here's the punishment for if you do it. Now, I guess one thing that I was thinking about is, like, I think all three of us would agree stealing is wrong, right? Your neighbor's got something, you dig, you don't have it, you go steal it, that's wrong.
Yes.
Would theft go up or would murder go up if either of those things were suddenly not illegal?
Oh, yeah.
You think they would?
Oh, yeah.
You think murder would go up if it was not illegal?
No.
No.
I don't think it would either. But theft, I could see it would, because it's easier to view that as a not quite as big of a victim crime. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I took that, but you got money, so go buy yourself another one, you know, maybe. But I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't go up. Maybe the same people that steal now would steal if it was legal, and the same people that I guess I'm wondering if somebody walks up to something and says, I would take this, but there's a law against it. Oh, I just can't do that. You know, that's not what stops me from stealing. I recognize that I wouldn't want someone to steal my stuff, so I am going to pay the same respect to their right that they got this stuff and I'm not going to take it. So lack of a law would not be an enabler for me.
Right.
But maybe it would be for some people. You know?
Well,
that's more to your point that government is not the giver of those rights, nor is it maybe an influence of behavior. So,
yeah, I would say the people that don't recognize that, we call them sociopaths.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, yeah, I do think it plays a deterrent factor. I mean, but dependent, maybe it's a graph between you get more, it's more of a deterrent on the more petty of the crime. You know, if there wasn't a speed limit, I would drive all crazy.
Well, deterrent, you know. Deterrent how?
Well, if you pick something petty, you know.
Because, I mean, we're talking about two different things. Like, there are people that would commit the crime except that there's a law.
Right.
Or there are people that would commit the crime except they're worried they will get caught.
Right.
And, you know, I think that group of people is much larger than the former.
Right.
You know, the people that just say, oh, well, there's a law against it. You know, I'm not going to do it. It's not because they're worried about getting caught. It's just because there's a law.
Right. Well, I'm just saying I would drive fast. That's what I'm telling you.
But you don't now, right?
I drive moderately fast.
Okay.
I kind of like, I just like.
This is probably a great example because I think Jerry's going to tell you should be able to drive whatever speed you want to. So,
yes. I'm more like passive aggressively taunt the law. You know, kind of get right up to that edge. That's kind of how I am.
Well,
beta male.
Actually, speed limit is a good example because it's a victimless crime. You know, when you're driving down the highway doing 70 miles an hour and you step on the gas just a little bit more, now you're doing 71.
You've
committed a crime, but you have not harmed anybody else.
But what if I show you a graph or stats that say when you drive over a certain speed, you're more apt to have an accident that does affect someone? Now you start to get into that.
Okay, so now
area.
It's become a numbers game. That
sure.
We're right. Well.
Or what do you guys think?
But government.
Should you be able to drive under the influence? Should you be able to get absolutely hammered and drive home?
Government's function is not to prevent crime. That's not a legitimate purpose of government.
Well, I wouldn't view that so much as I don't think they probably view it as preventing a crime as they view it, you know, protecting.
Right, right.
Well, you're still trying to prevent something from happening.
Sure.
And that's not government's role.
It's trying.
So making you wear your seatbelt. If you want to drive without a seatbelt on and get in an accident and go flying through your windshield and get cut in half, that's your gig, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the only reason anybody cares about that is because we have socialized health care. So they, you know, they'll immediately make the claim that, oh, well, if you go out and hurt yourself, everybody pays for that because, you know, you just end up driving up health costs for everybody else. So we have to prevent. But, you know, if that's the case, then start the list of all the risky behaviors that are out there. You know, people who skydive, people who launch model rockets, people, you know, that list is endless. We would have to ban all of that activity by that logic.
Well, I would say there's a line there somewhere, and it depends on who you're asking where that line's at.
Yeah, well, so that line is completely arbitrary.
Oh, sure. No question.
And,
yeah,
and
I agree with that. I think it's all very arbitrary.
Well, see, I have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because rights are digital. You either have a right to do something or you don't. They're not analog, you know. And we try to turn them into analog rights by, you know, assigning this potentiometer to your right and then electing somebody to put their hand on that knob and, you know, decide where it should be.
Right. Well, and I think it's very easy. If you agree to some fundamental set of things that you can step back and say, look, you do have a right to this, you can get a second order effect from that somewhere that you can have a debate with somebody that's going to say, I think we should do something about that. And somebody else is going to say, no, that's a step removed. I don't think that's part of the equation. And I think that's where you're arguing. If I say you've got a right to life, and then we see that when people go out and get drunk and drive, they invariably have a higher rate of going out and killing someone. Well, I've got to protect those potential victims. So therefore, I'm going to say you can't drive drunk.
Okay.
So who's right and who's wrong in that case? I mean, I think that gets into a gray area.
Well, I don't think it's that gray because you're presuming that there's a right to be safe and that the government is stepping in to protect that right of yours. And you don't have a right to be safe from harm.
I don't.
So no. Where's the right to life versus the right to be safe from harm? I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I think that's a very fine distinction that 99.7% of our population couldn't possibly begin to fathom.
Yeah. Well, if I would return to Jefferson's interpretation and the way, you know, that he described it is that we are all we're all circumscribed by, you know, our own equal rights. And the only time that there's an injury to someone else is when you cross that line, you puncture that membrane that separates us all. That's when you've violated somebody else's rights. And, you know, until that happens, then there's nothing anybody else can do to you.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very hard thing for people to accept.
I know it is.
So to say, you know what, I'm going to get crocked and I'm going to drive 95 miles an hour and, you know what, as long as I don't kill anybody, I'm not doing anything wrong. But the second I kill somebody, the second I do violate somebody's rights, that's when we're going to act. I don't think people will accept that.
Well, that's what it
means.
That's
obvious, I mean, right?
That's what it means to live in a free society.
I agree with that. And we talked about this some on our 9/11, you know, this very same topic came up in a more roundabout way, you know. We think those rights with these kind of preemptive strikes on things to, you know, preventive measures.
Right.
As opposed to reactive measures. And I think ultimately if you want to be free, you have to be 100% reactive. And we clearly as a society don't accept that.
And isn't it one of the things that makes this society efficient? The idea that we have some reasonable expectation of safety when we're walking down the road. I mean, as far as to talk about, I know this is more of a Jerry thing than a Ken thing, but you know, if you're talking about a strong economy and a country that whose money flows like it, like everybody wants it to, there's a structure of safety there that backs all that up. That if I'm walking down there to buy something at your shop, that I have some reasonable expectation you're just not going to take my money and kick me out the door.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just saying that's what makes there's something in there that makes the society function. But that it's not just a incrimination on liberty and rights. Although mm-hmm.
I agree, that's
not all it gets.
That might be all that you know Jerry or someone thinks it should do. But I think that order and that structure, as precarious as it might be, I think that's an expectation of a lot of people.
Well, who is ultimately responsible for that, though?
For
maintaining that stability.
Well, you mean like, is it the government or not?
Well, yeah. I mean, because the next step in that argument is we are the government, right?
Sure. I was going to say it's the people's responsibility. Allegedly. Because we elect those officials that we task with outlining what that structure is going to be. I mean, we ultimately are the ones that do that, right?
Yeah.
Directly or indirectly. I mean, we may elect someone that then goes in and puts their version of that on there and says, okay, you can't smoke in a public place, you know, because secondhand smoke is bad. You know, you can't play your music too loud because that's disturbing the peace. You know, you're starting to get into multiple steps removed from those rights. And perverting them into something that someone could make an argument that they somehow trace back to something, that this is a good thing. But it's so far removed that I think, you know, you can also look at it and say, well, I don't think that's reasonable, but someone else does. That's why they did it. I don't think people do these things typically as far as passing these laws and such to be malicious. I think they genuinely think they're doing something good. And the effects of what they do might even be good, but you have to ask yourself if it should even be done in the first place. And what are the ramifications of that? You know, the driving example is perfect. You know, you're trying to prevent something that might happen. And when does that go too far? When you're trying to prevent something as opposed to, you know, punishing a crime that has already happened and is a violation of somebody's right.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to what Rob said about this reasonable expectation of you know, whatever in society, that's how, you know, that's what makes our economy efficient. That's what, you know, allows us to live the lives we live. Because I don't know what that expectation is, really. I mean, do we have that now? Because there's an awful lot of stories about gunmen out there shooting up people at random.
But that's not the bulk of 380 million Americans' daily lives, right?
No.
So, I mean, the fact that it's happening at all is not evidence that, you know, the system has failed.
But how bad does it have to get before you say that we're no longer, you know, safe,
it has to affect me.
Your economy.
Seriously, that's what most people will tell you.
Well, yeah, right? You're right.
I can watch it on the news and it's like, yeah, whatever. Okay, but something happens to me or my house or my kids,
thing. That very standard is not an objective one.
No, not at all.
So while I might agree with you that it does make your economy more efficient and it does make the standard of living better in a society, it's not something you can define well enough to, you know, legislate it it's just something that is. It's a byproduct of the people and the culture. You know, it's not something you establish first and then everything else falls out of it.
I don't know.
Silence,
yes. Deep in thought. Yeah, I don't know. I still think the whole rights thing, although I think they are what the majority of people will recognize them to be. I think it's still a construct. I don't think they're de facto truths. I think they're only true because we believe they're true. Because we've evolved to the point where we say, I'm going to choose to recognize this.
Well, they're not true like they're like law of gravity. That's just a theory too, kind of like theory of evolution.
Right.
But it's not
I think they are. I mean, I think they are objectively true. I'll include a link in the show notes to this video. It's called The Philosophy of Liberty. And I'd encourage all of our listeners to watch it. It's a 8-minute video on where our rights come from. And basically, everything derives from the notion of self-ownership. So if you believe that you own yourself, you know, that no one else owns you, then there, you know, you can derive all of the rights to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. All of those come out of this notion of self-ownership. So, you know, I think that those rights are objectively true for that reason. And, you know, I know you guys haven't seen the video, so you can't really comment on it, but it
I
is
can
pretty
still
cool.
comment.
All right. Feel
that
free.
Was terrible. There wasn't enough nudity. I was terribly disappointed. Yeah, I guess I have to watch it because I don't know how those things, in order for them to be true, they have to be recognized. They have to be agreed to.
They
you
can
know,
be
I,
true
I just don't know how they
can
exist
recognized.
In and of themselves.
They can be true without people actually, you know, without them being universally recognized. They can still be true. You know, that's what morality is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it comes back to what we said before about having a right and having the ability to exercise it are two different things.
Yeah.
I think everybody possesses a right to life. Everyone has a right to liberty, but they're not always allowed to exercise it. But that doesn't negate the right.
Mm. Right.
So it's kind of like, and we've talked about slavery before. The slaves didn't, they weren't allowed to exercise their right to liberty, but it didn't mean they didn't have it.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah, and I can make this argument, and I can clearly tell you that I think slavery is wrong, and murder is wrong, and stealing is wrong. So, I mean, I recognize those in my own morality, but I still think those things don't exist in and of themselves. They exist because we choose to recognize them. And I can choose to not recognize them, and somebody else can choose to recognize them and say, well, here's my expectation of what my rights are. And they may very well be right, but there's going to be people out there that aren't going to agree with them.
Okay, but you know? if you choose not to recognize them, you have to know that what you are doing is wrong.
I don't know if people like that do or not.
Yeah, I mean,
did
you
slave
may,
owners think they were wrong?
You may do it anyway. Not, you may rationalize it in your own mind, but but you have to know that what you're doing is wrong.
I don't know that I can't say that they have to. I don't know. I can't peer into the psyche there and see if maybe they know they're pulling a fast one and they know deep down it's wrong and their conscience is eating at them, or if they go, this is perfectly reasonable. I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, I don't think the slave owners thought they were doing anything wrong. They're just working that free market. You know, they're just doing what they were just using product, basically. They needed fields plowed.
Yeah, I mean, because that's all it was viewed as, right? It was an industry. Right. It was a product. That's exactly right. Now, did they deep down in their heart of hearts know that, God, this is terrible. But it's good for me, so I'll keep doing it. I don't know. I think it was just an accepted part of society at that time.
Well, I think if that were true, we would still have it.
That it was accepted part of society?
Yeah.
Or that they didn't? Well, but it clearly was, though, right? I mean, there was some segment of the population that thought this was wrong. But there was some other segment that thought it was fine.
Right, but...
And ultimately,
are you saying that we just eventually reached a tipping point where the majority... felt it was wrong, and that's why it went away?
Was it the majority? I can't speak to whether it was the majority or not. I don't know.
I mean,
but it did eventually go away by whatever mechanism, right? The Emancipation Proclamation said, we're not doing this anymore. All slaves are free.
Right.
So, I mean, that was the act of a single person. Now, did he independently come up with that? No. I mean, there was a movement there, obviously, to end slavery. So there was some segment of the population that recognized it as something that was wrong. And there was a whole economy that was, you know, dependent upon slavery, you know, that they thought couldn't survive under that, under a freed people's directive there, that was not going to help them. So I, whether it was the majority or not, I don't know.
So why did this, maybe this is on topic, but why did the slavery thing exist, you know, from time immemorial, and then, you know, right around the time we seem to kick the habit, as it went around the world, it seems like at least our European dominance thing kind of went by the wayside. But it seems like slavery kind of all it went from being everywhere to not so much everywhere, all within a pretty quick span there, right? Do we agree on that?
Yeah, I was just trying to think, because I know Europe, I mean, yeah, you go any place and it had the same, you know, evolution, I guess, you know, from having a people who are in control and a people who are oppressed and who are enslaved, to recognizing that was wrong. And that, I don't know the time frame, though. I think we think of slavery as kind of a uniquely American thing, because that's the way it's woven in our study of history, because it's a very American-centric. But that same thing happened, you know, in virtually every other country in the world that existed, you know. But I don't think we talk much. I don't remember learning about the European slave market, you know, in grade school. You know, that wasn't taught. So I don't know if it ended around the same time, or if they ended before and we kept going, or if they ended after us. I don't know the answer to that. Do one of you?
We need somebody that knows stuff on this
podcast. We do need somebody that knows stuff. You're right. That would be great. Or someone that has access to the internet. That would be really cool, too.
Yeah.
Internet's too hard to use.
That is hard. But that sounds like a good thing to look into and
well, maybe
understand I'm going in here. So
we'll have to research that and maybe cover that in more depth next time.
But if so, it raises a question, like, is there – it's a nice way to think about it. Is that the human conscious as a globe, or at least as some hemispheres, you know, can kind of have an awakening in these sorts of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also say, now you just go crazy, I'll say that part of our rift with the Middle East and the hardcore Sharia law peeps over there is that we're having a human conscience rift there. We're of two separate mind states, and that's what causes, like, we're all here living in 2011 or whatever year it is. So here we all are. We all have iPods, and everyone knows there's satellites. We know the moon goes around the Earth, or so they say. But it's the fact that a Western mind is a different mind than a Sharia mind, and we don't conceive things the same way, causing these sorts of problems. That the same sort of conscious awakening has not happened, or there's a difference there, and it's causing problems. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can see, as far as, you know, if you want to talk about just the subset of the human population that subscribed to Sharia law. I can see that they are going through a renaissance of sorts at this point in time, that, you know, Western culture seems to have gone through 500 years ago.
Right, right. That's mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm talking about. Right.
Yeah. And
so you think there's some timeline, some progression, some evolution there that's kind of palpable that a society has to go through, and they're they may be behind, but they're coming to that same point.
Right. That's how I see things, maybe from a big...
And the European-centric societies kind of all went through this at roughly the same time, within 100 years of each other, maybe, or whatever.
Right, and that's why we just don't understand each other. It's not like it's not a language thing or a cultural thing or...
They don't want to blow up our strip malls?
Yeah, it's just...
Are you sure that's not it? Okay.
It's almost like talking two different languages in the most fundamental way possible, you know?
I think
it's not about intelligence or brightness or cultural validity or you know, the artistic quality. I'm not talking about any of that. It's just...
Right.
Yeah, it's just...
But I think we put it in those other terms because they're easier for us to understand. Something, and I'll you know, Eric's not here to speak for himself, but something him and I have talked about, and I'll steal it, is we... tend to think that we can just make people think like us. Just
right.
Here's how we think, and it makes sense to us, so it should make sense to you. And you're looking at it from just, you know, whatever confusion we have talking between a liberal and a conservative, when you take the same piece of information and interpret it differently and say, well, here's what I think about that, it's exacerbated by the fact that their society is completely different than ours.
Right.
And you could argue the merits of it being right or wrong, but you know, you could also not look too far back and see that maybe we were in a similar place at one time. So it just kind of is. And you can't – I don't know that you can judge them based on that or say, well, they should flip a switch and just be like us. That's not going to happen.
And the rift is caused because they're now living in our world.
Right.
You know, we win because we're farther along. So now you get to learn about UAVs, you know.
Seeking weapons that blow your people up who don't agree with us. So.
Right.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think you look at Japan and you look at what China's going through right now, and you know, exposure to that type of free society. It doesn't take long for people to go, "Hey, wait a minute, I'm kind of digging that. You know, I want some of that." So, and I think that awakening maybe is happening. I'm just poking around on here, looking at when various countries banned slavery. France abolished slavery in 1794, but it was reestablished by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1804, and it was permanently abolished in 1814.
Okay.
Denmark, Norway banned it in 1848. So, I mean, you're talking within like a 50-year period here. A lot of these countries are falling in line, and maybe we are at the end of the train, but it all kind of happened around the same time.
Yeah. Right.
That's interesting.
And why? Why, one might ask.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because I think we just take a very American-centric view to the slavery phenomenon and the story. And, you know, that's just all we kind of look at because that's what we do. So, interesting. I can't find what Britain's story was. I need to look into this a little bit more. But I think your point is well taken that a lot of this happened around the same time. So there's kind of some human awakening in the European-centric societies that said, hey, wait a minute, you know, a certain amount of us think this is probably not a good thing. Maybe we should do something about it. And I don't think it has anything to do with the majority. I mean, the civil rights movement I would look at equally and say, did the majority of people want to keep the status quo, or did they want to, you know, recognize that just because someone's black doesn't make them inferior and they should be equal? It is a morality thing, and it's something – it doesn't matter if 1% or 100% of the people believe that. It is something that should be viewed as fundamentally true, which goes back to where does that fundamental truth come from? And all I can tell you is I recognize it and say just because someone's black or someone's white, I shouldn't judge them any differently or treat them any differently. I know that. But I also know there's people that don't believe that, and they will treat someone differently, and they're perfectly okay with that.
So maybe I'll get smart on this, but I think there was a – I have a sense that there's a certain way we did it. There's a certain way the U.S. did the slavery thing that made it maybe more unique.
The way we conducted slavery or the way we –
Right. That has much longer term consequences. I don't know if this is completely right. I mean, please, listeners, tell us if we're wrong. Which
don't let
are.
That stop you.
You know, if you think about the Dutch, you know, they had their little West Indies things, and they were certainly doing their trade stuff. But so they were making money on the backs of other humans, like like other European cultures as well as our own. But they didn't bring the slaves to the Netherlands, as far as I know. Maybe they did, but I don't get the sense that they were, you know, working the Netherlands fields. They were out bopping around colonizing other countries and taking advantage of people elsewhere. And I think what might make it uniquely American was just, you know, we brought it all here, and then it would, now it's all our nation. Now we have to pay the price for what we did to ourselves, you know. Like, I think when the Dutch ditched the West Indies, they're like, all right, see you later, suckers, you know. We're done with this colonization thing. They were just done with it.
I think you've hit on something there. I mean, we provided a market that turned the slave trade into an industry.
Right.
And I don't think that is true anywhere else. Certainly wasn't true outside of the colonies. You know, the established countries of Europe had slaves, but they weren't, you know, the market wasn't as strong there. So the guys who were going to the trouble of sailing down to Africa and, you know, gathering hundreds of people and, you know, all of the logistics involved in that, they weren't going to make enough money selling those in their home countries to make it worthwhile. The only right. place they were going to make a profit was in America.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, I think we were unique in that respect.
So right. slavery existing just for a recognition of who's on top and who's on the bottom of society, as opposed to, like you said, building up an industry around it. That's a right. very different thing.
Right.
Just saying, hey, you're going to, you know, bring me my food and do whatever and be my slave, quote unquote. That's very different than you're going to go work these fields and you're going to create something for me that I'm going to make money off of.
Right.
Well, looking here, I did find the little entry on England. And interestingly, England kind of self-realized, I guess, in 1772 through a court case that slavery did not exist under English law. But interestingly enough, at the time of the Industrial Revolution in America, 5% of the British economy was based on slave trade with the colonies.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and they go on to talk about they had a similar moral awakening that said, like, we recognize this isn't right at home. Why is it okay to make money off of it, you know? But they didn't stop for a really long time. I mean, that was a small percentage of the people, apparently, that were recognizing this moral dilemma they were in, where they knew something was wrong, but they were also profiting from it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so interesting. So basically, your claim that, you know, that how we see slavery from a uniquely American perspective, and maybe that's a, you know, some kind of liberal guilt. I think it's more than it's, I think.
But maybe
it
is unique. Maybe that's
right. True. That's what I'm trying to say. You know? Right. Right.
But I do think we don't really. It's not like America woke up one day and said, "Oh, you know, it'd be awesome if we had some free labor to work these fields." Right, you know, it didn't come from that.
It's, that's true. We don't see slavery
as old as
people.
Right. 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 And we got it from other people, and maybe we perfected it. You know, maybe we Americanized it and made it into a juggernaut. You know, we turned it into the Microsoft of slavery because that's what we
as
do.
As we do,
know?
Right?
Yeah, we do with everything, and we did it with slavery the same way. And we're like, we're going to take it and we're going to push it to the nth degree and screw this, bring me some tea and rub my feet crap. Let's go make some damn money. You know, that's what we did with it. So interesting.
So To kind of get back onto the topic of rights, we all agree that we're all created equal, right?
Sure.
So no, everybody's got the same rights. Whatever that set of rights is, we agree they're equal from one person to the next.
Agree.
Sure.
Okay. So if I tell you that I don't have the right to do something, whatever that happens to be, that necessarily means that you don't have that right either, because I am claiming that, you know, I don't have that right. I know that I don't.
He's trapping us here. Be careful, Rob.
It's like when I play chess and I just like happily move pawns
around.
Oh,
look, my queen is out there just all by herself.
Yes. Okay. I agree.
So, well, where I'm going with this is, and it's covered in the video too, so you guys really need to watch this, is the right to rule, okay? We only have the right to rule ourselves, okay? But we don't have a right to rule other people. Would you agree with that?
Isn't there a distinction between rights and, I mean, law? I mean, does law have everything to do with rights, or does it have to do with more than that? I would say not everything that's a law has to do with a right.
That's definitely true.
So, I mean, by law, if we agree that we're going to appoint someone to rule us, quote unquote, then that person has the legal right to rule us, but it's only a legal right because we've given it to them. And I would argue it can be taken away.
Well,
and I would argue anyone should.
It's not a legitimate, I mean, that it's an unjust law if it's giving them rights that, you know, that don't exist otherwise.
But I think, you know, you could be elected president, right?
Yeah, in theory.
So there you go. You have the same legal right that any other potential candidate has. Only one person can be president at a time. We can't have 380 million presidents. You'll argue that we can, and that's where we're going next. But I mean, I think by the letter of our law, there can only be one, and we elect that person. And anybody age 35 or older, born in the 50 states of America or Haiti, can be elected president. So,
or Kenya.
Kenya, sorry, whatever. I got my third world toilet wrong. But, yes. So, I don't know. I see where you're going with that, but I wouldn't call that a right to rule. That's not a right. That's a law is different than a right.
Well, okay.
So, when does a law infringe upon a right, though, is probably another place you could go with that. Giving that person the legal ability to rule infringe upon your rights?
Well, let's simplify things. I don't have a right to tell you what to do, right? I mean,
you
I can't
tell me what to do.
I can't generally order you around.
Not with any expectation of me doing it. Yes.
Okay.
That's true.
And the same is true for you. You don't have that right. Rob doesn't have that right.
Right.
But now, if you and I get together and we vote and decide that we're going to tell Rob what to do, is that legitimate? I mean, we took a vote and, you know, the majority, 2 out of 3, said, yeah, that's what we're going to make Rob do. Is that legitimate?
Depends what we're telling them to do, I guess, and if the law allows such a thing. But it could very well violate the rights that we're talking about. Yes, I see where you're going.
Well said. Boy, that took you a long time to get there.
So if it doesn't work with 3 people, how do we expect it to work when we scale it up to 300 million?
Because everything works better when you scale it up.
Right.
Cars, houses,
software.
See, this is the
Michael Bay movies. They all work better when they're bigger.
This is the logical fallacy of voting, of, you know, government authority, all of that is.
But in its place, what you would advocate, I would argue, is no more enforceable or better or immune from corruption and any number of other things that would render it invalid.
Well,
I believe.
Perhaps not, but at least it's logically consistent.
I don't know that. I think you could argue the merits of that, because I still think under any kind of private system, you don't have universal agreement that something is an authority. So if you recognize an authority and I do not, I don't think I have any ramifications to my actions, and nor do you have any jurisdiction, or that entity that you entrust to protect your rights doesn't have any jurisdiction over me. I don't know how that would work. I would argue not very well. you know, I think it would be. I mean, I think what would happen is it would settle into something very similar to what we have now eventually, but maybe it would start off differently. But
so you're just talking about how a system of justice would work.
Yeah, just how one would enforce, you know, something that I you view you've been wronged by me,
right?
And you want, you know, reparation for that. And
well,
I think that's a very legitimate thing. I just don't know how that would happen if I don't subject myself to the same authority that you view as protecting you. I don't know what would happen to me.
Well, you trust the 12 members of a jury to render the correct decision.
But who appoints that jury? The people that you pay to protect you or someone that I pay to protect me?
Neither.
Neither.
Well,
so who would that be?
Well, it would be a third party whose job it is to, you know, run a court or run a mediation service or, you know, whatever it is. I don't
but who
know.
Who would pay them? I mean, you say neither, but then how would that exist if no one pays them in a free market?
Well, whoever your agent is that's representing you. And whoever
Scott
my
Boris.
Agent, yeah, whoever right. my agent is, would be paying for a place, you know, a physical place and a, you know, a logical place to hold a trial.
I don't see how that would work because I have a different motive. My agent has a different motivation than your agent at that point, right? This doesn't sound any different than the current system. You're going to have...
Your agent has the same motivation. He wants to keep you as his customer, and he wants to spend as little money as possible on you.
Right.
That's his motivation.
Okay.
So he has to keep you by presenting you with a system of justice that you believe actually renders a just decision. And the same is true for my agent.
So what if they can't agree on what that should be and where that place is and who the 12 jury members should be? And
well,
then does nothing ever happen?
No, something's going to happen because whoever brought this dispute in the first place wants it resolved, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. If you want it resolved, you've been wronged. I may want to slow roll this thing and be like, nothing happened. It's all good.
Maybe.
So I don't show up for the trial. I don't recognize this kangaroo court because I'm already guilty and this is stupid.
Okay. So my agent.
What happens to me?
My agent goes to your agent and says, all right, you need to go arrest him and bring him to court. And if you don't, we're going to arrest him and bring him to court.
I don't know what authority those people have over me.
Same authority that the police have under our current system.
Exactly. But what we give the police that authority, and I haven't given your people that authority.
Or
recognize that authority.
When did you give the police the authority to do any of that?
Well, I haven't personally acknowledged my belief in that, but it's a fact of our society that exists. So if the policeman's behind me and the lights are going off, I'm going to pull over.
You were bound by the terms of a contract that was signed 230 years ago.
True.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll include a link to Lysander Spooner's writings in the show notes as well so that our listeners can read about the Constitution of No Authority. Because that was one of the points he made, too, is that, you know, the Constitution purports to be a contract, and yet, you know, it really was only legally binding on the individuals who signed it. Because, I mean...
Well, I mean, but the same argument would apply here. What if I haven't signed a contract with your people that are going to come arrest me? What authority do they have over me?
Well, they are acting on my behalf, and
okay.
I have delegated my right to compensation to mm-hmm. them. So they are operating underneath my right to be compensated for the injury I've suffered.
So they can come arrest me and come take something from me to repay you.
Yes, because if you're an impartial – now if Rob, say, is the impartial third party who is presented with all of these facts – he's going to look at that and say, okay, yeah, that's legitimate. This guy, you know, Ken hurt me, and Ken didn't want to show up at court, so my agent went and arrested Ken and brought him to court to face, you know, to face the music.
That Ken guy.
And Rob is not going to have a problem with that because that is legitimate.
So what if Rob is corrupt and is not, in fact, impartial, but is masquerading as impartial? Is there room for that in that system where the system would get corrupted?
That might happen, but, you know, you would have a lot of different courts to choose from. And if one started to get a reputation as being corrupt or being, you know, biased in some way, I think that would affect their ability to.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they were biased in the sense that, hey, I'm going to get some more money, I'm going to take a cut and give you a cut, you're going to use them. You don't have an incentive to go impartial in that case, is what I'm saying. You have incentive to pick the court that's going to render the decision you want.
Okay, but your agent and my agent have to agree on the court.
Well, so, okay, what if they don't?
Well, they have to.
You can't make them.
Well, I mean, it's in both of their best interests to find.
Not if I'm guilty.
Common ground.
My agent wants to keep me out of trouble.
Well, but the longer it drags on, the more it costs him. He's not going to do it indefinitely.
My only point is whatever system that we have now that is rife with corruption because it involves people. Any system you contrive is going to have that same opportunity, and people are going to game it, and people are going to work it to their advantage.
And I won't deny that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know that your model is any better. I think it will evolve to roughly the same model because this is just what we do. You know, the same thing where we had this human awakening in the 1800s that slavery was wrong, and the same way that the Arab community is going. I think there are things that societies go through. We have kings and we overthrow kings, and we have democracies or republics and we march along the path and we want everything to be fair, and we pass, you know, obtrusive laws that some will argue are in the good of the people to protect them from themselves, and some would argue are stomping all over the rights of individuals. But that's the path we go down as people. You've seen Europe do it. You see us do it. Eventually you'll see China do it. You'll see all these countries do it because it's just what we do.
Well,
and if you turn the whole thing upside down and start it over, and
I would hope
400 years, we're going to do the exact same thing.
I'm not arguing with you. I would just say I hope that the next step on that path, that inevitable path, is, you know, another round of enlightenment where we realize that, you know, centralized governments that have monopolies on the use of force are uncivilized.
I hear where you're going with that. I mean, yeah. I hear that. That's the hope.
I can't disagree with that. Because no different. That is rife with corruption, right? I mean, it's the same argument. I mean, when you get to a point where the power is consolidated to a very few, they may have the best of intentions, or they may not. But it doesn't matter what they're doing. They're doing under the pretense of there are no ramifications.
Right.
What I do here.
And it's under the color of law.
Yeah, right. Right. No question. So
all
just
right.
Because it's the inevitability doesn't make it right. I just think that's what we do.
And I think it's good to hear. It's always surprising when I hear Jerry say words. But it's just it's
with many syllables.
There's a lot of words and syllables. That it's not so much an indictment. It's not that. I think what Jerry's saying isn't a traditional kind of like, in America we've lost our way, you know, that there was 100 years ago, or really only, you know, 8 years ago before Obama took office. You know, there was some glorious time. Yeah, there was some glorious time where democracy was pure and rights were right. Free, and you know that he's really, it sounds like you're really making more of an indictment of the idea of the way the democracy was set up, and at least it was more correct at the beginning, and it's just getting worse and worse. But the idea of a democracy and people voting in laws, and or just even the whole idea that we could sign a law tomorrow that say, hey, you know, there's 52% women and 48% men in the country, and women are going to decide to vote that all men are, I don't know, whatever you want to fill in your own blank in there. But they could do that majority rule there on that issue, and that's allowed by the Constitution. Now, it might go to the Supreme Court and, you know, get a 5-4 on that thing. But that's the way the democracy is set up. But you're raising more fundamental concerns, like does that even violate a fundamental right that a majority can decide what how they're going to treat my inalienable rights?
Yes, exactly.
See how I listen over here.
I mean, I think that is what a republic is. It tries to recognize the rights of the individual as supreme over what would otherwise be mob rule. But like Franklin said, it's a republic if you can keep it. And I don't think we've done a very good job of keeping it.
Yeah, I think there's a real distinction there between law and how we enforce that and what that all means. That's I think sometimes when we talk rights and we talk laws, I think those things get mixed up. But I think what you're saying is when you take something as a law that you think is for the greater good and you trace it back a few steps, you can see that it in fact is infringing upon a right.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll find that either the law itself is violating a right, or you have to violate people's rights in order to enforce the law.
So one could hardly argue that if drunk driving was gone, you know, things wouldn't be better. I mean, obviously not having people drive drunk is a good thing. So
yes.
I guess what I'm saying is the effect of a law may in fact be good, but that doesn't make the law necessarily okay.
Right.
And I think that's a very tricky area to
well, it's a pretty hard it's a pretty hard sell for
about the seatbelt law. You know, I mean, a lot of laws exist to protect you from you, right? I mean,
yeah.
They're not there to protect someone else from you. Whether you get in an accident going 900 miles an hour with a seatbelt on or not doesn't affect that other person at all. But it affects you. So why is that seatbelt law there? What about child seat laws? You know, that kid doesn't have the wherewithal to climb into a car and say, hey, mom and dad, put me in my car seat. You know, if you let them sit on the dashboard, you know, they're going to dig it. But that may make you a crappy parent, but should there be a law that says you have to put your kid in a car seat?
Drop this one on you just as a ponderable. The idea of like motorcycle helmet laws.
Sure.
Just be like, I don't care if you're driving down the road and you crash yourself and you don't have a helmet on, what's that got to do with me? That's right. What I used to think. And then someone mentioned like, all right, so I have a fender bender with a car. Okay. I get out and we exchange phone numbers. I have a fender bender with a guy on a motorcycle. I might plunk that guy over and he skins his knee or something. I have a fender bender with the guy without a helmet. I'm up for manslaughter.
Right.
You know, so I've made the same mistake. Or you know, the road was slippery. Maybe it wasn't even my fault. But say it even is my fault. So I make the same mistake in those three cases. And because of a choice that the motorcycle rider made, you know, I'm in much deeper water there.
Yep.
So that decision that he made really did affect what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. It gets pretty tricky pretty quick, I think.
I would like to explore that in a later episode maybe, but we're about out of time. So I want to thank all of our listeners as always. And we've had a couple of new people, I think, like us on Facebook. So
really?
I want to say thanks to the new listeners.
Do we know who these people are?
I think so.
Are the people that actually listen or just people that we bribed into making this?
I don't know yet. I haven't gotten any feedback from them.
Okay.
But hopefully after this episode, they'll let us know that they're listening. And so we want to say thanks to them and tell everybody to visit us at facebook.com/MidwestPeace. Or you can go to MidwestPeaceProcess.com. And leave us feedback in either place. We'd love to hear from you. And we will be back next week. with another fun-filled episode. I'm not sure what our topics will be yet, but we'll come up with something interesting, I hope.
Of course we will.
Obviously. Sure. So thank you, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.